An Illinois lawmaker says the FDA policy for blood donations is outdated and discriminates against gay men.
A gay man who is monogamous and particularly practices safe behavior should not be deferred. They should be allowed to give blood like anyone else.
That's Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois' 5th District. We'll talk with him about what he would like to see change and why he's not attending tomorrow's presidential inauguration. The Big Mac is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and yesterday, McDonald's expanded the Big Mac family, WPIX explains.
The company is testing various sizes of the iconic Big Mac, and according to a press release, will soon offer a Grand Mac and a Mini Mac Jr.
Plus, two economists are looking at why people are working more part-time jobs, even though they don't want to, and the future for primates like gorillas, monkeys, and lemurs looks grim. What's going on? We'll talk to anthropologist Paul Garber to learn more. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week in Washington, D.C., a 21-year-old man donated blood. It sounds simple enough, except that that man is gay. And because of current regulations on gay men donating blood, he could only donate if he abstained from sex with other men for 12 months. Representative Mike Quigley of Illinois' 5th District says this policy is outdated and discriminatory. He wrote about this in a piece for the Huffington Post, and he joins us now on the line from Chicago to talk more about this. Representative Quigley is a Democrat. The 5th District includes Chicago's north sides and several west suburbs. Representative Quigley, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Can you help us understand what is the thinking behind the current policy regarding blood donations from gay men? And this was put in place, this is put in place by the FDA, right?
Right. This is a decision that was spawned, I suppose, at the highest point of the AIDS crisis. When the crisis began in the 80s, there was little or no scientific understanding of what was taking place. And obviously, there was a great deal of fear as to how this was how this disease was being transmitted and who was susceptible. So a pretty draconian decision was made that any man who had sex with another man was going to have a lifetime ban from ever giving blood. We began working on this in 2009 with then-Senator Kerry to try to have the federal government, the FDA, Health and Human Services, change this policy. Because as you know, science has finally caught up to this. With advanced screening and understanding, we're able to understand how obviously disease is transmitted, and with the screening prevent the dangers that were apparent in the past. It's just taken a long time for government to catch up with this. So it is a discriminatory policy. It is one based on the fears of the 80s and not the knowledge of present day.
And that said, has there been any update or any effort to update this by the FDA in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the government has moved painfully slowly. It went from a lifetime ban to a one-year ban. And obviously, unfortunately, you know, Jay had to be celibate for an entire year. You know, he was making a point, and a very important one. I appreciate and respect his efforts. He took a risk, and he's made a tremendous sacrifice to make this point, once, you know, it stemmed from the Orlando tragedy. But what finally happened is they reduced the lifetime ban to a one-year deferral. We don't think they're there yet, obviously. I think the blood donation industry recognizes that. And the AMA announced in 2013 their official support for moving from a time-based deferral to a behavior-based deferral. Let's appreciate the crux of the contradiction here. A straight man who has risky sexual behaviors, has multiple contacts on an unsafe basis, is not so banned. A gay man and often a 30-year monogamous relationship practicing safe sex had a lifetime ban and now a one-year ban. So clearly, this should be based on someone's behavior, not their orientation.
Now, that left-hand ban was just actually, the changes you said, that was just in 2015, so that wasn't
that long ago. Yeah, we've been pushing for this. Yeah, we've been pushing this from 2009 on, and it has been a slow push. The government has had a number of studies and analysis on this, and I think we're getting there.
What would you like to see? What would you like the screening process to look like?
Well, first, I think people who engage in high-risk behavior should be not allowed to give. I don't care if you're gay or straight, but it's discriminatory when you just say that gay men who practice risky behavior should be deferred. And honestly, a gay man who is monogamous and particularly practices safe behavior should not be deferred. They should be allowed to give blood like anyone else. I support what the American Medical Association says. That is, this should be based on behavior, not on orientation. We've had improvements. We've had the government move toward this, basing the screening process on deferral based on behavior, not orientation. And as the screening improves, I do think that's where we're going to get. It is an extraordinarily complex process for how blood is screened. The nuance would take a long time to get into, but I think the government is at a point where they recognize that as that science improves and they make a few adjustments to how they're screening this, the risk is just not there.
Representative,
besides being discriminatory, mm-hmm. is just not having enough blood.
And I wonder, I know that your vice chair of the LGBT Equality Caucus is, I don't know if that's how you first became passionate about this issue. What was it in particular that you said you've been working on this since 2009?
Right. Well, friends of mine, who classic situation in which someone or a large group of people feel the need to give blood. In this case, a friend of mine had a crisis, a medical crisis in the family. And the entire family went to give blood. He was told he could not because he was a gay man. He was told that there was a lifetime ban. Since that time, I had heard from many gay men who were placed in a similar situation. And the reaction is uniformly one, first of surprise, anger, frustration, humiliation. The community, like any other community, rises to the call. After Orlando, the community rose to the challenge and came to give blood, because the cruel irony with the Orlando tragedy was that innocent people were killed, and the second tragedy was those targeted who wanted to help those who were victims were not allowed to help. So I heard about this from friends who, through national disasters or family issues, wanted to give blood, were told they could not. So that's when we started working on this in 2009. It was a simple desire to increase the blood supply, the safe blood supply, so that we were all safer, and to end an injustice because of the fact that this was a policy that didn't belong anymore.
Representative Quigley, before we let you go, I just want to ask one more question about the inauguration of President-elect Trump. You're one of three Illinois lawmakers who are not planning to attend. Why?
Well, you know, for me, it was just a question of sending messages. If the inauguration is about pomp and ceremony and a peaceful transfer of power, the fact that I'm there is I get it, a ceremonial one. And it sends messages. But I do think that President-elect behavior and his comments have gone beyond the pale of decency, particularly in his attacks on my colleague, Congressman John Lewis. I suppose it's not that there wasn't enough reason not to go before then.
But was that the point for you at that point?
That was the point of just enough is enough. He needs to appreciate the fact that there are lines that are drawn. So it is not that I disagree with the president-elect's policy on issues like climate change and gun violence and a woman's right to choose and many, many others. You know, you still respect the office. But I think the president-elect has not respected almost everyone else's views that he disagrees with. But in particular, his attacks, his misogynistic, bigoted attacks were right at the brink. And then it just put it over the top when he attacked probably the most respected member of Congress, a historical figure who risked his life on many occasions for fairness and equality for all. So at that point in time, you need to send a message. Again, maybe ceremonial, but you're letting him know that there's some lines you don't cross.
That's Representative Mike Quigley. He's a Democrat. Illinois' 5th District includes parts of Chicago's north side, several of its west suburbs. Representative, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Representatives Jan Schakowsky, Luis Gutierrez, Dan Lipinski are among Congressman Quigley's colleagues who have said they will not be attending tomorrow's inauguration. Republican Governor Rauner has also said he won't be there. He says he needs to focus on what's happening here in Illinois. The Big Mac, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, will now come in three different sizes: the Mac Jr., the Classic Big Mac, and the Grand Mac, the Oak Brook Braced. McDonald's has rolled out plenty of major changes in recent years, including the all-day breakfast that saw some success last year. We're joined now by Peter Frost. He's a food and beverage reporter with Crain's Chicago Business. He's on the line from Chicago. Hey, Peter. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So listen, Big Mac tested, I know, earlier this year. Is the Big Mac so popular that now McDonald's wants to do three different versions? What's behind this menu change?
Well, they tested it last year, Nyla, in about 425 stores in Columbus, Ohio, and Dallas-Fort Worth. And the test must have gone well enough for them to decide to roll this out nationwide. The Big Mac is obviously, as you know, one of the most, it is sort of synonymous with McDonald's itself. It's the most iconic sandwich that they have, and they've never shown much of a willingness to mess around with it. Under CEO Steve Easterbrook, who's been there for a couple of years now, the idea is to take these sort of iconic products like the Big Mac, update them, and create a little buzz around them, and that's what they're doing here. So they're making a big one and a small one, and they think that this limited-time offer is going to, you know, spark interest and drive some sales.
Okay, so it's a limited-time offer. Well, wonder how much this is about. We've heard a lot about fast casual restaurants. You wrote about chains like Red Robin or Five Guys. Does McDonald's consider those direct competitors? Do they think the Big Mac is like a burger that competes with like a Five Guys or a Red Robin burger?
I think that's part of it. They, you know, McDonald's has tried and failed several times to create a more upscale burger. And by upscaling the Big Mac here, they're taking something that people are familiar with and just making it a little bigger and maybe a little bit better in the Grand Mac case. Yeah, I mean, I think they realize that they do need to step up their burger game if they are going to compete with you know, this rash of better burger restaurants out there, like, you know, like Five Guys, Smash Burger, Red Robin, et cetera, the ones you mentioned. And I don't know if this is going to, I don't know if this is enough.
Well, it's the same burger, right? I mean, it's just like the big one, the Grand Mac is literally just like, it's the exact same thing. It's just bigger, right? It's just the amount
right.
of meat
I mean, they're
is
using,
more.
Yeah, it's just a bigger slab of meat, essentially. So
and the bigger bun, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right, of course. Well, the regular Big Mac has, 10th-pound burgers or whatever, and the new one has two 1/6-pound of beef burgers. So it's just a bigger slab of meat, and you know, it's supposed to be juicier and taste better. I don't know. I haven't tried it yet. Have you?
No, I haven't tried it yet. I don't like the special sauce. I feel like I need to admit that to the world. That's why I don't like Big Macs. And I don't I don't know. Can you request not a special sauce? I feel like that's not something that McDonald's lets you do, but maybe they do.
I don't know. I bet you probably could, because that's part of what they're moving into, which is an odd segue. But, you know, McDonald's realizes that the millennial generation in particular wants to customize their food. And McDonald's is really trying to go down that path by installing kiosks, these self-ordering kiosks in all of their restaurants nationwide, all 14,000 plus of them, because they know they need to customize better. So maybe you will, within the next year or so, be able to order a Big Mac, Nyla, without the special sauce.
And then I will eat the Big Mac. There we go. And then the Mac Jr. is just a smaller size. It's kind of like a Whopper Jr.
Yeah, that's right. So it's again, a different size of beef than they typically use. It's a 6-pound patty. And it's supposed to be easier to eat on the go. And I was talking to a couple of franchisees about this, and they think that the smaller Mac or the Mac Jr. will appeal more to women, in fact.
Huh. Okay. And I, by the way, my millennial producers are saying that you can 100% order it without Big Mac sauce. So there we go. Everybody, that's about right. The special sauce. That's directly from the control room. So we'll assume that's good inside information. Last question for you, Peter. We just have about a minute left, but...
Yep.
All of this, the all-day breakfast menu, big success for McDonald's, but, you know, you sometimes hear complaints from franchise owners about all of these different menu items and customization and how hard that is. What is the sense of now adding 3 more items to the menu, how stores are going to respond to that? Is that going to be tough?
Well, the only thing that they're adding is they're adding 2 different sizes of buns and 2 different sizes of patties. So franchisees, I think, are a little bit concerned that the menu has grown so bloated, and now here we are adding something else. But they're also, you know, fired up about the opportunity or the chance that this might bring in new customers. So it's a balance. And all-day breakfast, they're used to that now, and they saw what it did to sales. So I think franchisees really are starting to get on board with some of these changes because they know they have to get traffic back into these stores if the company's going to do well and they're going to, you know, have money for their own, for themselves.
Peter Frost covers food and beverage for Crain Chicago Business, telling us about Oak Brook-based fast food giant McDonald's. Hey, Peter, thanks for being with me.
Nice to talk to you again. Take care.
Coming up, speaking of McDonald's or part-time work, we are going to be talking about part-time work and how much that's changed in this economy, looking at how many more part-time workers there are, even though the Great Recession has passed. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 6 years into our economic recovery, the amount of people working part-time because all the work they can get is actually at higher rates than it was before the Great Recession. That's according to a report published last month by the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning Washington think tank. It's called Still Falling Short on Hours and Pay, Part-Time Work Becoming the New Normal, and was written by economist Lonnie Golden. He's a research associate with EPI and based at the University of Illinois, and on the line with us now from Chicago. We're also joined by Susan Lambert, who's a professor with the University of Chicago, is a visiting scholar this year with the Russell Sage Foundation. Lonnie, Susan, thanks for joining me on The 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Lonnie, can I start with you? I think a key part of the report is, you know, we see all these headlines about how the economy has recovered, lots of economists talking about a full employment situation. But this is, I think, a key part of the picture here that a lot of people miss, which is how many workers are working only at part-time jobs, even though that's not what they want?
We still see about 6 million people are working part-time jobs, which is defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as working 34 or fewer hours, but they respond that they're willing and able to work 35 or more. And within those 5.5 to 6 million workers in the U.S. now, the part that remains elevated above what it ought to be at this point in an economic recovery are those that take part-time jobs because that's all they could find.
Right. And I think what we're also seeing, Lonnie, which you highlight in this report, is also the rate of this type of work, how much this is growing. In fact, it may be, how would you categorize how fast the rate of this type of work growing is?
Well, in terms of number or rate, it's significantly higher than it was before the Great Recession. So we say about 4% of the workforce is in this condition now. And I would add that a lot of workers want more work hours, even though they're full-time or that they're part-time and don't necessarily want to work full-time hours. So this is 4% is the tip of the iceberg. We find in other surveys as many as about a third of the workforce are looking for more hours and more income.
Mm-hmm. And where does Illinois rank in terms of people working part-time jobs in an involuntary way?
Pretty much near the middle in the median, a little closer toward the top. So it's not in the top 10 of part-time for economic reasons, but it's near that. So That can reflect a couple of things. It could be that people want more work hours and they need more income, or they're more ambitious about their income. But we also think it might reflect largely what employers are doing in particular industries like retail and like food. And we think that compared to before what they were doing before the recession, that there are more part-time jobs being created where they could create full-time jobs. So perhaps the distribution of industries in Illinois reflect the fact that many employers could be creating two part-time jobs rather than one full-time jobs. There might be some indication in the last year or so that this is coming to an end, but it's not there yet. So Illinois is pretty reflective of what's going on nationally.
And Susan, what do you think's driving, what do you see as what's driving employers to use more part-time work? Why is this happening?
Well, for the last 30 years, basically, many employers, especially in service industries, have been moving toward a business model that very much relies on and values labor flexibility. And that's flexibility from the employer side. So being able to use labor just when you think you need it in terms of customer demand. And then in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been new technologies that have become available, especially to major employers, that allow employers to both look at changes in demand, often every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes in terms of traffic or sales, for example, in retail, and then look at staffing levels. And so to really what has been called in the retail industry, at least, in terms of optimizing your workforce, which means just using labor when, you know, the most observable parts of demand are there.
And Lonnie, you mentioned this, and I think Susan's sort of alluding to this. We're seeing this a lot in industries like retail and hotels and food service. But there's also a clear, I think, demographic difference that you highlight in terms of what are the demographics of most of these part-time workers? What do they look like?
Well, first let me add to what Susan is saying, which is that part-time jobs are more flexible in that they can be used by employers to meet demand on demand. And so the demographics are going to reflect who holds part-time jobs. We find that the rate of part-time for economic reasons, which we call involuntary part-time, is about 3.7% among whites, but it's upwards of 5 or 6% among black and Hispanic groups. We also find that it's distributed by age pretty evenly. That is to say, we get prime age workers, the 25 to 54-year-olds that are in these type of jobs. It's not just younger workers or older workers.
And you mentioned retail, leisure, hospitality. Are we seeing this, for example, in other industries like manufacturing? And I'm thinking in particular of employers. Susan, here I'm thinking of Caterpillar employers that are going through, who kind of go through cyclical reasons for that, why they're kind of shrinking and growing their workforce.
Well, what we see in some recent national data that focused on workers who were 26 to 32 years old. It's a national panel sample, and that's the, you know, kind of the work, the respondents that they had. But there, what we see is that those kinds of jobs are not necessarily characterized by part-time work, but they have other aspects of work schedules that make it very difficult to hold a job and to also fulfill personal responsibilities. So one of the key problems of these jobs that are often part-time and where hours are scarce, and also there are these other jobs in the economy that have these other aspects as well, is that they also, the hours can be unpredictable and unstable, and workers can have very little input into the hours that they work. And so jobs in manufacturing and construction, which we can have, you know, that are male-dominated occupations, are highly the work hours fluctuate a lot from week to week. Often the workers in those jobs don't know what their schedule is more than a week in advance, and they have very little input into when they work.
Mm-hmm. And Lonnie, you talk about this. You have in the report, you talk about, in particular, inflexible or schedules or how tough that is. You write about this. Why is it important to have companies maybe try to make workers and schedule and pay as predictable as possible? How would you propose that they do that, and why is that so important?
Well, it's important from a couple of standpoints. Most of us that are employed are trying to navigate through daily and weekly life, and having more certainty and having more stability about what our work week is going to look like helps us plan the other activities, whether it's our families, whether it's commuting, whether it's furthering our education. All these things add up to it being very important in the aggregate. And when we're looking at these particular sectors where part-time is higher than it used to be, and they're using short-term worker hour fluctuations to meet demand and fluctuations, in a sense, the companies, the organizations are passing off to their employees this instability. And that's what we think needs to be addressed with policy. But I just wanted to add that from before, a lot of sectors like manufacturing construction that Susan Lambert mentioned, they use other ways to be flexible. They hire temps, they do independent contracting, and put people on rather short schedules or short notice of schedules because of that. So all of this reflects a sort of cost shifting that's understandable from the companies, from the firm standpoint, but it plays out in people's lives on a daily basis. Compared to people that have more regular schedules, people that have the irregularity in their schedules tend to have more work-family conflict, tend to report more work stress, holding everything else constant.
One other disadvantage, I think it's probably obvious, I mean, now we've talked about, I think that's something people don't think about with part-time workers if they're not in that situation, sort of the chaotic schedule that it might involve. I think it's probably obvious that part-time workers are paid less. What other big disadvantages do you see to this involuntary part-time worker economy that's kind of developed, Lonnie?
Well, I would add that if you're an hourly paid employee, it's a much different situation. So those of us on salaries, we might understand that it's part of our job to have unpredictable hours, but we at least then have stable pay. So if you're hourly, it's going to be hard to plan your expenses, particularly longer-term expenses like housing, if you don't know what your minimum income is going to be or your usual income is going to be.
And what about benefits? What do we see in terms of access to healthcare, for example, with part-time workers? What does the data show there, Lonnie?
Well, the data at the national level show that there's much lower coverage rates among those who are part-timers. That's one of the major reasons an employer would use a part-time job, are the cost reasons, at least in the short run, that it's cheaper to hire a part-timer. There are reasons to convert that person or that job into full-time, but for the time being, they save on the health insurance and other types of insurance expenses. So the benefits for part-timers are typically not proportional to their hours, so that they have much less paid time off or little to no benefit coverage at all. And, you know, we could add that that's exactly what's at risk with removing the Affordable Care Act, which allowed people to either be taken into their pools offered by their employers or to get subsidized to purchase insurance on the exchange.
You know, Lonnie, I want to get back to the Affordable Care Act in just a second, but Susan, can I ask you just if we're thinking about more part-time workers, particularly in certain industries, I wonder how employers are changing things to create cultures around part-time workers, especially with benefits. I'm thinking, for example, of Starbucks, that maybe recognize a company that seems to recognize that a lot of its workers are part-time but still offers benefits to part-time workers. Are we seeing more of that, or what? How are we seeing different companies kind of deal with this?
Well, I just happened to spend last weekend at the National Retail Federation's Expo in New York City, which is where all the vendors come who are selling systems to retailers, and retailers around the world actually come. And it was very different than kind of the themes have been in the past. And the whole theme of the conference was on how do we engage our associates. And they were focused on their hourly part-time associates. And so there are new systems that are coming out that allow employers, if they so choose to do so, to establish minimum work hours for their employees, to provide stable schedules from week to week, to make sure that their employees are getting the training that will position them for advancement in their firm and in the industry. So I saw that as, you know, kind of quite promising. Now, it takes time for retailers and any big business or any business to change. And so these are changes that are on the horizon. Right now, we still see in the national data that part-time workers are left out in terms of many benefits and in terms of advancements and in terms of, you know, wage equity.
That's helpful. Thanks, Susan. Lonnie, can I ask you about the Affordable Care Act? Because one of the arguments we've seen, and you talk about this in the report, is that health care coverage, in particular Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and some of its provisions have created more part-time workers. Is that true?
There's some evidence provided by some economists that maybe by a couple few hundred thousand, that part-time for economic reasons is higher. But we looked at it in a more time series fashion, meaning the trend seems to indicate that just when the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's sometimes referred to, when that was actually implemented and enforced on employers for the contribution that they don't cover their employees, that's actually when the part-time for economic or involuntary reasons started to decline. So it's really hard to argue that the Affordable Care Act, which defines full-time employees at a threshold of an average of 30 hours a week, had much of an impact at all. In fact, there's some evidence now that suggests that more people than involuntary part-time people, voluntary part-time seems to be going up. That is to say, a lot of people who are working 35 or more hours, precisely for the reason you mentioned, which is that usually gives them access to health insurance coverage, can now reduce their hours down to 30, given the choice. And therefore, we get kind of a wash in the effect of the Affordable Care Act. So the timing doesn't line up really well. It might be having some residual effects, but at some point, employers aren't going to take that 30-hour threshold into consideration so much if there's a lot of customers and a lot of clients. Having said that, there might be, particularly the not-for-profits or state, local government work, which has very limited budgets, and they might be the ones most tempted to reduce people's hours who were maybe 32 per week in a contract down to 28 or 29. That makes sense, but we don't see much of an effect of this at all in our data.
Well, and I think that goes to the question about what happens next over the next 4 years under a Trump administration. So we have to take a break. But when we come back, that's the question that I just want to pose to both of you, particularly looking at the proposals, the appointments for the Department of Labor, Carlin Hardy's restaurant CEO, Annie Putzer, someone who specifically said, for example, he opposes increases in minimum wage. I'm curious your thoughts about how you all see all of this playing out over the next 4 years. So we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'm going to have Lonnie Golden and Susan Lambert answer that question. We're talking about Lonnie's report that he authored for EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, about falling short on hours and pay and part-time work becoming the new normal as part of our American economy. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Is part-time work the new normal? We're looking at rates of people working part-time because that's the only work they can get higher than it was before the Great Recession. That's according to a report from the Economic Policy Institute. One of its authors is with us. Lonnie Golden is a research associate with EPI. He also is at the University of Illinois where he's based. Susan Lambert is also with us as well. She teaches at the University of Chicago. She's co-director of the Employment Instability Scholars Network as well. And Lonnie, Susan, that question I was asking you guys before the break, so we're thinking about an incoming administration who's talked about dismantling the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. We're looking at an appointment of the Department of Labor, someone who specifically said, from the specific industry we're talking about, saying that he opposes increases, for example, in minimum wage. Lonnie, how do you see this playing out in the next 4 years in terms of the specific things you would like to see fixed with part-time workers to help? How likely are we to see things happen, these kind of benefits we're talking about for part-time workers?
Well, I can't be very optimistic, obviously. I'm at the University of Illinois for the new project for middle class renewal, and we have a mission to improve the living standards and address some of the inequality issues which were discussed during the election. I'll read you really quickly the Department of Labor's mission, which is to foster, promote, and develop the welfare of the wage earners, job seekers, and retirees of the United States to improve working conditions, advance opportunities for profitable employment, and assure work-related benefits and rights. So in the president-elect's first move, he appointed somebody that probably should be in the Department of Commerce, which well represents the business interests that are large and small businesses. So I don't know about whether that appointment is going to go through, but I think there's a statement there about the seriousness of pursuing the improving living standards for workers and the well-being, which we're trying to address at the Project for Middle Class Renewal, and particularly the issue of inequality, which has two facets. It's not only between skilled and unskilled workers between in households, it's between labor income and property income, and a lot of our inequality comes from the growth of property incomes and the stagnation of labor income. So one would hope that the part-time issue would be part of the equation in terms of improving the day-to-day and annual growth in living standards of those in part-time positions, both from their pay and from their benefit coverages.
Susan, apart from the federal level, all of these changes that are most likely on the horizon at the federal level, I'm curious about cities and states. I know in August, Seattle passed laws requiring like some businesses in the city to give hourly employers advance notice of scheduled pay, some of the things we were talking about before. I wonder, you know, we've seen, for example, different things in Chicago that lots of people see as progressive policies for workers. I'm thinking of Chicago and Cook County, for example, mandating sick leave policies. Do you have a sense that we'll see, in particularly in Illinois, any laws on the horizon for example, like in Chicago, to do what Seattle has done?
I do. I think that what will happen in the next 4 years is, and what has been happening in the last few years, is that a lot of the policy innovation is happening in municipalities and in states. And there is every reason, I think, to believe that that will continue and maybe intensify, given that there's unlikely to be much action at the federal level. In Chicago, there is enormous support and movement toward more extended leave policies, as we know, but also in terms of scheduling legislation and in terms of providing some of the basic work hour standards that are now in law in San Francisco and will be going into effect in Seattle and in Emeryville, California in July.
Susan Lambert is co-director of the Employment Instabilities Scholars Network. She's also an associate professor at the University of Chicago. Lonnie Golden, as you've heard, work he's doing at the University of Illinois. He's also a research associate at API. We've tweeted a link, by the way, to that entire report. So if you follow us at 21ST Show, you can read of all of Lonnie's work. Lonnie, Susan, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great being here. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The future for primates like gorillas, monkeys, and lemurs looks grim. That's according to a report published yesterday in the journal Science Advances. To learn more about what's going on, we're joined in studio by one of the report's authors, Paul Garber. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. Paul, thank you for being here with me.
My pleasure, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
You know, in this study, you found that 60% of primate species are now threatened with extinction. About 75% have declining populations. Those are pretty remarkable numbers. What's happening?
Well, our report was really the first to look at this worldwide. There are non-human primates in about 90 countries worldwide. And previous studies had tended to focus on single species or single areas. And basically what's happened since pretty much the year 2000, there's been a dramatic increase in agricultural production and the conversion of forested lands to agricultural lands in the tropical regions where primates live. And that's caused a cascade of effects that have really resulted in a major decrease in the populations of primates worldwide.
And what species are we seeing most at risk?
Well, there are several, and
and I guess I'm saying extinction, obviously.
Yeah. Well, for example, Madagascar is the fourth largest island in the world. It's located off the east coast of Africa. There are lemurs in Madagascar, over 100 species. These lemurs live in Madagascar. That's the only place where they're endemic there. And over 90% of the forests in Madagascar have been cut. So virtually all of these 100 species of lemurs are endangered. Similarly, in areas of China where I work, for example, there's a species of gibbon. A gibbon is a kind of ape, and there are less than 25 left in the world, in the wild. They live on an island called Hainan Island in China. And there are many primates where essentially all of the forests have been cut, and these animals are living in really the most inaccessible areas under really difficult ecological conditions.
So I think many people understand and agree there's cause for concern for species going extinct. But I wonder what you see as the biggest damages to different, or what the loss is when we see different species that are becoming extinct. Some people might think, why does this matter? Isn't this the natural course of evolution?
Sure. And I think the message of our work is really twofold. And the first is primates have been on this earth for about 55 million years. They're the third most speciose group of mammals.
We should say we are, right? Because we're considered primates.
Yeah, we're primates too. And so there are more species of bats and more species of rodents, but then primates are the next most speciose group. So primates have lived for 55 million years, and I think no one could argue that what's occurring now is natural. It's human created. And primates are part of these tropical ecosystems. If you remove this element, if they become extinct, many of these tropical systems will just collapse. But the second part, I think, of the message that we need to really understand is that if humans continue to degrade and pollute and destroy environments, that the primates are like the canary in the coal mine. If our closest biological relatives can't survive in these environments, then in the not-too-distant future, we won't be able to survive in these environments. So it's imperative, even for our own self-interest, to come up with more sustainable ways to protect these environments and these animals.
So this morning we were looking at the maps in your article where primates are in the world today, concentrated in regions in Central and South America, parts of Africa, Southeast Asia. And I understand two-thirds of all the primates we're talking about live in just four countries, Brazil, Indonesia, Madagascar, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. Did we see primates in more parts of the world? Are we seeing such declining populations that this is where the concentrations are now?
No, they're declining worldwide. Their concentrations are simply those are places that have traditionally had extensive forests, like Brazil is the largest country in South America. It has a huge Amazonian region. So this is the natural distribution, and these four countries just have amazing diversity. And so they're regions that I think international organizations, governments, businesses need to. This is our problem. We've created the problem. And I think we need to help these countries so that they can sustain these populations.
And when we say we've created the problem, you're particularly talking about agricultural expansion, how that's coincided. You talk about this in your article about the decline in forest cover and how that sort of correlates with agricultural expansion. And I think part of the issue here when we're thinking particularly about developing countries is As the world population continues to grow, we need to produce more food. So are there ways to increase food production that don't involve deforestation?
Yes, there are. I mean, and again, I think the key to this is to be sustainable. So there are things, areas where I've worked, for example, in Nicaragua, where people leave the forest, but it's called agroforestry, and they plant coffee, for example, and they use the shade, the natural shade of the forest trees to plant coffee. You can do that with things like cardamom and other resources. But another thing is often companies for profit will go into forested areas and cut them to sell the wood first and then use the land for agriculture when there is existing land in that area that could be used for agriculture, but it may be less profitable because if they cut the wood and extract the resources, the company can make additional money. So part of this is it's profit-oriented, not sort of smart way of protecting the environment.
And is this a macro problem? Is this a big problem with big businesses that are destroying habitats? And then we're seeing these higher rates of species loss? Or is it something that's happening at a smaller level in communities that maybe need those trees for survival?
It's occurring at a sort of global, international, macro level. In fact, we have many conservation successes, but those are at the local level. And, you know, in the U.S., we say all politics is local. Well, all conservation really starts locally. You have to engage the local community as stakeholders in working with them. You need to respect them and find out what their needs are. Often, for example, I've worked in places where if we could help for a local community to develop a clinic, for example, or help build a school for them, those are the things that get them to want biological research stations, protected parks, because if we can bring them the what they need, then they want to work with local governments and local researchers in sustaining and developing that. So what we, I think, need to do is almost take the local models and bring them up to the more national level.
And are there places that they're doing that well, you think?
Yeah, we are. I mean, I've worked with both in Nicaragua and Costa Rica, where we've worked with local communities where we've asked them what their needs are. And often, for example, on this island in Nicaragua, the island is called Ometepe. It's a very large island in Lake Nicaragua. Lake Nicaragua is the largest island between Lake Michigan here in Chicago and Lake Titicaca in Bolivia. So it's a huge lake. And they had problems with garbage and burning. And we worked with the local community. They asked us to help them build a school. And we developed a program where we got the local people to collect plastic bottles, water bottles, fill them with disposable items, and we actually used then these plastic bottles as bricks that we could build a school building and cemented that over. So rather than have them burn the garbage, which is really toxic, or bury mm-hmm. it and it'll be there forever, and we actually ended up building a school where local children can come for free to learn English. And this was what the community wanted, not because they wanted to become us, but because they can get better jobs if their kids are bilingual. And mm-hmm. So
those are ways you think you can see scientists working better with local communities to help solve these bigger problems that we've been talking about. Paul Garber is an emeritus professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out the link to his report, which was published yesterday in Science Advances. Paul, thank you for being with me.
My pleasure.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we're not live on the air in the morning. It's exactly going to be the time when Donald Trump is scheduled to be officially sworn in as our 45th president. Stay tuned to NPR all day for special coverage of Inauguration Day. Next week, we're going to be looking at a Trump presidency and how a new administration in Washington will affect key areas of our economy. We're going to start with agriculture. My question for you is, what do you want from the Trump administration, especially in the first 100 days? Email us at talk@21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Have a great day.